Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
And I want to welcome you to a very, very special event that I wanted to do for a very long time, because this one includes a lot of my, let's say, opinions about Jung's work and Jung's approach itself, because how I've done it before with all the events and the topics was always to say, okay, I really try to see it completely through the Jungian lens. That's why I read all the books and try to stay as close as possible when I talk about this, that I don't use the secondary sources. I use his primary sources. Everything I talk about has normally a reference somewhere, maybe a book, a letter, a seminar, or an introduction somewhere. And here I want to go a little bit meta into Jung and his work and think about, okay, where do I see some inconsistencies or white spots or things where I would say, okay, this is a way how to approach it, but it might not be, let's say, completely true. So first things first, I have to say Jung's work is incredibly coherent in itself. So he published for over 60 years. And it's amazing how he does not really change his mind, but rather goes deeper and deeper into context. He starts with a certain level and then goes below, below that, below that, below that. So he does not really abandon ideas. He still has them in the background. This is why I also mentioned very often in the past that it's necessary to understand his psychoanalytic background, to understand his views on anima, animus, or the collective unconscious, or even ions, or alchemy, that he's coming from a specific point of view that he always builds on top. And it's incredibly coherent. For the complexity and the amount of ideas and concepts that there are, it makes, in a big part, incredible sense. Everything is new that he talks about, and his ideas and concepts and the connections are new, and it's still very much coherent. It's difficult to get into because it's just very complex and it's really a lot, but if you go through it, you're surprised how well crafted everything is. So it's hard to explain everything. This is why I have now published 27 episodes where I talk about specific concepts and ideas. And it's, let's say, scratching the surface, doing everything very bare bones and in an easy, approachable way. But he, with his works, is, of course, way more comprehensive. And in some cases, even more detailed. And this is already amazing to work so long, being so coherent, and everything makes sense and clicks together, and not to greatly change the mind or contradict himself is amazing. So nitpicking about this is already, let's say, not in a sense of cruel or mean, but rather to say, okay, engaging with Jung's work means also to take an outside perspective, even maybe a modern perspective. And the work he has done has happened in a time where, let's say, the scientific method was not as developed as it is today in regards to psychology. And he worked just differently. For example, Jung could not do statistics, something which is incredibly important today for psychology to evaluate data and to interpret it, to be able to do high-level statistical work. This is something that when people want to study psychology are very surprised about, that it's a lot of mathematics, but he could not do it. Why do I know this? Because later in his life, he searched for mathematicians that help him regarding statistics for the signs that people have, the zodiac signs, to see whether there's any distribution effects when people come together in relationships, for example, that there are certain signs that really aren't attracted to each other. And he asked statistics experts for that because he could not do it. So, of course, hindsight is always easier to judge certain things. But I shared a list before because I was asked, so who looked into it might know these bullet points now, but I will go them through. It will be kind of a mixed bag because I have different topics that I found interesting and to talk over worthy about. And my very first one is in regards to his interpretation of symbols and connection between symbols. For example, some years ago, I reread the Greek myths And there was one myth where goddess turned into a bear. And I read that and then thought, oh man, Jung is right, because he wrote about how the bear represents the female psychology. And I thought about that for 2 seconds and then thought, wait, it has to be the other way around. First, there was the Greek myth, and then there was Jung talking about. So knowing his background of mythology and fairy tales and all these things, he, of course, not came up in a vacuum myth that the bear represents the female psychology, but rather he saw it in the mythology and thought, oh, okay, there seems some relation, because in the past people talked about this relation. That's why they formalized it in this myth where there's a goddess that turns into a bear. And this brought me to a train of thought where I thought, yeah, let's say you want to do an algorithm for determining, for example, what movies people like, a recommendation algorithm as Netflix have it or YouTube has it. There was many years ago when Netflix started a grand prize and a grand idea how Netflix could improve the result, because the better the recommendation algorithm, the more people would watch Netflix and pay money for it. So what they would do, they would take a data set and give it to people and say, okay, here's a data set. Please try to find out which is the best algorithm to recommend movies to other people. And what you would do normally in machine learning, you would separate the data set into 2 sets of data. One is the training data, one is the evaluation data. And you would make an algorithm based on the training data. And you would, of course, try to validate that algorithm. That means it's not only you can find connections between movies, right? And what people watched and what they liked and what they disliked. This is not so hard. The thing is, you want an algorithm that's not only helpful in this set of data, but in general. This is also why you always need to have a testing data set. So you have your algorithm that you made in the first data set and you test it with the other one. And only the other one will tell you if you're accurate or not. Why do I use it in the context of Jung? Jung uses a data set, and this is mythology, fairy tales, religion, and so on. But this is also a very fixed data set. It's not like that we have a continuous stream of new religion, mythology, and so on coming up, which means he had to look only into the existing set, take what's there from, and say, ah, the bear represents the female psychology because it's always in connection with the female. But there's no data to really falsify it, which means with Jung's ideas, how with the meaning of symbols could running into an overfitting problem. It makes sense in the body of work that we have, but it does not mean that it has to be general applicable to human psychology. If we would have more data, it could look different or more differentiated or all completely wrong. So to verify this, it would be necessary to find, for example, new mythological texts and check them against the ideas and concepts that Jung had. But this is very unlikely to happen because Jung lived in a time where all these texts were translated into English and German and, let's say, the European languages, and then be approachable also for Europeans. That's from India, from China, but also from South America. So it's a limited data set, and it's not, he's kind of always right because he cornered that market already completely. And there's another concept that explains it, which is called the sharpshooter fallacy. For those who have not heard about it, the idea is if you want to evaluate if somebody is really a sharpshooter, if really somebody can hit the target, you have to have the target first. Means in the sharpshooter fallacy, the sharpshooter first shoots into a wall and the sign is drawn afterwards. And it shows, I'm very accurate because the sign is done afterwards. In this sense, it cannot really be known if Jung's views on the symbols and the uses of mythology is saying something about the deeper layers of human psychology conclusively, because we have no data to falsify it. And this is something that bothered me a little bit, but I cannot really blame it in him, and there's nothing much he can do differently. Jung was very open. Jung took everything serious, and he talked about everything. So he did not ignore these things. He talked about these things, and he looked at all those things. So his theories could be the most comprehensive because they looked at everything, but that's still not necessarily enough to really prove them 100% correct. And this is a bit where I struggle with the interpretations. And he also says at the same time, when you have Jungian background knowledge, your dreams change and you're influenced by the ideas of Jung. This is also why Jung liked to do dream studies of people that he had very little contact with. For example, Wolfgang Pauli, the famous physicist, he talked with him for 15 minutes, found out, okay, he's very smart and he's also in huge distress. So he told him, okay, I'm not going to talk with you. Talk to my assistant and record your dreams. And Pauli did this for hundreds of dreams. And only then Jung looked at the dreams because he did not want to influence Pauli in his dreaming and his associations that he would have regarding the dreams. So Jung already tried to get additional sources of information for symbols and the interpretation through the dreams of his patients or through the visions that they have. But yeah, in the end, it's again a little bit limited. So having this all comprehensive view that he proposes very often, that there are some symbols that are so ingrained that they have a specific meaning, for example, the snake, also associated with the body for Jung, there's still this little speck of doubt in the back of my mind where I say, okay, oh yeah, this is just, it's the method problem. It will always be hard to verify that. But this is something that bothered me for some time. I walked around with. The next topic is, and this surprises a lot of people when I say that Jung warned about the unconscious, like a lot. For him, how he is presenting it or talking about it, the unconscious is similar to a wild animal or bad weather, like a big storm. You have to find a way how to deal with it and how to survive it. And he says the unconscious in general is just stronger than human beings and can rip apart the psyche of a human being. And then the persons are not able to live their life normally. At the same time, Jung makes the unconscious look incredibly cool. Super interesting. He says, oh yeah, the unconscious, by the way, is where all the creative things are happening. And yeah, you can basically see the future because you can see how civilizations will develop. And yeah, by the way, there's also where the potential of you is. And then he says, yeah, but you should not look out the unconscious. Ah, it will come by itself. And you should not approach it. You should not look for archetypes, even though that they're shaping our lives and our history and our cultures and are incredible. And we build all these systems around them. You should not look out for them. So this is a kind of dichotomy that I think it's a little bit hard to grasp because he speaks a lot about the unconscious, but at the same time says, oh, this is, by the way, is dangerous. And yeah, you should not touch it. You should not deal with it. But it sounds all very, very cool. And everybody wants them to investigate and say, oh yeah, I want to record my dreams. Oh yeah, I want to do active imagination. But for him, it's like, oh no, you should not do this. It's like, if you are normal human being, you should not bother with the unconscious. Like when everything is set up properly, you don't even have the unconscious. And he said that about Catholic people, where he said, okay, those are the ones with the least psychological problems back in his days, because they came less to him in his therapeutic practice. And he says, yeah, well, their psychology is in the church, and the church is taking care of everything, and they basically have no unconscious, because an unconscious is always a sign that there's something in disharmony in the psyche. But yeah, at the same time, he talks about all these very cool things with the shadow and the anima and the animus and the self and individuation. This is all happening in the unconscious, same with vision or dreams. And he's selling it pretty well, only then to say, oh yeah, by the way, do not bother with it. So it's like a warning, but it's not such a strong warning. If the warning would be pretty big, then he would not talk about it, at least in my mind. So this is always a weird balance to grasp. And this rift between the things that Jung says and how Jung acts, I always see in another topic, which is important to him because it says it's important for the modern mind. He says the modern human beings, they have a very strong consciousness, they have a very strong mind, but they're in the danger of inflating away and living such an abstract existence that they have no roots in the ground. There's no life coming from below. The goal and the importance that human beings in the modern world have is to connect with the body and the bodily and the earthly. And he says this is happening already for hundreds of years now, that in the West, Christianity as a spiritual religion that discounted the earthly and was looking towards the sky and saying, oh yeah, this earthly existence is just temporary and it's supposed to be ugly, but in heaven you will be perfect, you will be free. He said human beings, or let's say the West, needed to move past that and discover the earthly again, and that this was done, for example, through alchemy and science, and that human beings were starting to explore the world. And he says this also has to happen in the psyche of people, that they need to discover their body, because the body is a thing that gets ignored in the modern world, where people live in apartments and they work in big companies and they only think their whole life, but they do not feel, they do not sensate, they do not intuit. He does not give any advice how to do that. So his whole therapy approach is still the talking cure. This is talking with people through their problems, exploring their dreams, exploring their mental landscape, exploring their relationships. And that's basically it. He does not even advise like, okay, go outside and walk in nature. He says people like to walk in nature and it's revitalizing them. But I never saw from him as a method in his therapy to say, okay, people need to go into the wilderness for 2 weeks and, I don't know, hunt their own food, stuff like that. His approach is still abstract in the talking cure. And interestingly enough, modern psychology, with the view on at least, let's say, medicine and certain drugs, is closer to related to the bodily than the things that Jung is talking about, because it's thinking about, okay, what the chemistry in the body. And you hear it very often when you have any kind of self-improvement. It's okay, look in the sky tomorrow when the sun is rising so that you get the melatonin being produced in your body, right? Also, you have to move or lift weights. This is already beneficial for mental health. So today we talk about these things. But for Jung, always talking about the bodily and integrating the bodily, he does really advise not so much about it. So now it's of course possible, as was back then a completely different world. People spent way more time outside, people had better food. It's all this is possible, right? But it's still strange. Just as strange as that Jung very little talks about other people, researchers, and their work, like in general. My comparison for that is I read The Interpretation of Dreams by Freud, and this is a really good, interesting book, because the first 100 pages or so is about taking all the theories that already exist about dreams and why they exist and how they work and so on, and looking at them and explaining them. And there are a lot of people I've never heard about because they are just lost to history, because the theories were not good enough. This is science. And he talked about all this to then take his own research and then came up with his own theory about that. This was already incredibly helpful to establish, oh, there's research done in the past and there were people with some ideas that have also been dominant at that time. And Freud was able to synthesize out something, so to have an idea that can encompass all these ideas, which is amazing to see. Like, oh, that's cool. It's not only a theory that goes beyond the other things, but can include the other things that already came before. It's nice to see. Jung is very self-evident about the things that he talks about, and this includes the work of other people. He does not mention so often other people, except maybe for Freud, and pointing out mainly insufficiencies of the Freudian theories in his eyes, which, if you look closely, are not so much different from his own views, because he also has a psychoanalytic background. And Jung is incredibly selective what he takes from people. And it goes up to a point where he even takes stuff from people that they themselves have revised. There is one French scientist called Lévi-Bruhl who came up with the idea of participation mystique, which is something that Jung really liked because it's about projection, that how you are completely entangled with the world because you cannot separate between yourself and the things that are happening outside in the world. And The thing is, Levi changed his mind about the theory and said at a certain point, okay, yeah, I don't believe this anymore, by the way. But Jung still used it. And he even said, like, yeah, even if Levi Brühl does not like it, I like it. And I will continue mentioning all the time. And he goes not really into the realm of other scientists, of philosophers, of thinkers. He rather goes there, grabs what he needs, and turns back. I would say it's different today when you look at certain people, let's say John Peterson, just for the closeness of Jung. What he very often does, he talks about the thoughts and works of a lot of other people and give context and give an introduction. Like, you had this scientist who did these things and had these amazing discoveries and all those things, that you also get an introduction into the works of others, that you have the feeling, oh, I can understand this now. And I learned something. And there might be even some things that do not fit necessarily with the theories that are presented, but are additional information that could be useful. And Jung does not that. It's always Jung and always the Jungian lens. He goes not too deeply into the works of others, and he does not speak so much about the works of others. So Jung is really in his Jung bubble all the time, which is a fascinating bubble. It's super interesting, and there's already so much there. But it's hard to believe that everything exists in a vacuum. So he does not mention people who do similar things as he does. He very often takes people who come from completely different fields and shows how this supports his theories. For example, Wolfgang Pauli, with whom he worked out the theory of synchronicity. Pauli came from a physics background and also quantum physics background. And Jung saw there, oh, that could explain certain things in psychology. And he would approach many things like this. For example, when he talks about Kundalini yoga, it's always in the context of individuation. So it's always to show, like, oh, you have Kundalini yoga. By the way, it fits exactly my theories and ideas of individuation, which makes a seminar that he gave on Kundalini yoga, not about Kundalini yoga, but about individuation. So all the other things that exist out there are kind of window dressing that supports his ideas and theories, which is, as I said, his ideas and theories are great. And a lot of research today shows that he was really onto a lot of things, but it's kind of weird. You can get lost in Jung without being in contact with a lot of other things. Also, where he's pretty, let's say, freestyle or nonchalant is his approach to dream analysis. So there is one seminar of his called Dreams, followed up by another one called Visions. And it is very much about the dreams and visions of a patient of his that he had. And I really try to understand his method of dream interpretation because he explains it. When you have a seminar about dreams, they are very good. I can highly recommend them. When there's dream in the title, it will be an amazing introduction and it will be super interesting. But at the same time, when you see how he interprets dreams, he proposes some methods and some ideas, but at a certain point, he has a small sentence on the image of the patient and it goes 50 pages in completely different direction. You go through the whole history of human beings and alchemy and national socialism and schizophrenia and all these things based on one little image. And I ask myself, okay, that's amazing that you can find so many tangents in one image, but how to replicate? How can it then be a reliable method that we can say, okay, this is now an interpreted dream? If an image takes 50 pages, okay, playing devil's advocate here, I could say, okay, maybe it was such an important dream series and such an important image. This is why he included it in his seminar about dreams, to show what is possible to read and see in a dream. But very often, when he would interpret something, he would stick to his own ideas and methods, but at a certain point, he's just going off and tangents. So this is also very much of his work. This is why it's very hard to read, because he's getting off tangents all the time. The longer the word, the harder this goes. This is why book introductions, for example, or smaller seminars are great, because they're focused and he has to focus and he really likes to go off tangents. And if this is the way how dreams are supposed to be interpreted, then I don't see any way how people could interpret dreams except for Jung, because he sees stuff which is really far out there, really far. It's great to understand his ideas and concepts, but it's like the question, okay, how did you get this out of this picture? This is really a lot. And his approach is really, he likes the dreams more that have less information. Because his thinking is, when you have internal experiences in your psyche, if you're able to formulate that, you already have a consciousness that is able to process that. So if you can speak clearly, this means you already have an understanding, which makes it, in a sense, also boring, because then it's not so deep below in the psyche and so deep in the unconscious. The deeper you go, the more foreigner and more strange it gets. This means for him, when a patient could not express themselves clearly, that was a sign that it was too far removed in the unconscious. It was not connected to consciousness or any previous experience, which made it then interesting, because then it comes from very deep, deep, deep parts. But at the same time, to get out more information when you have less information begs the question, okay, how much do you really interpret into there? And this is something that I would rather see, that Jung is filling this then with all his knowledge and all his interests and all his ideas, which again makes it then difficult to have a standardized way of interpreting dreams, because you would have the knowledge and the experience of Jung to do that. So this is something that always bothered me about his dream interpretation. And there's another thing that bothers me also, or let's say where I struggle to completely comprehend if I understood it correctly or whether he is hiding something, in the sense of he has a lot of concepts, let's say in the personality psychology and the psychology of the personality of a person, where it says, okay, you have four functions. You have thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition, and you also have an orientation, internal, external. And basically, you can be anything. You can be an outward thinker. You can be an inward, central guy. This is absolutely no problem. You also have deep down the logos and the eros, the separating function and the combining function. And all those make up your personality. For example, if you are more on the logos side, it's likely that you're more male. So men and women both have logos and eros. But if there's more logos, that's in men. And if there's more eros, that's in women. And this is also why he says, okay, logos is masculine, a masculine force, and eros is a feminine force. But it always means you need to have both. So like a man, you need a strong feminine side. And as a woman, you need a strong masculine side also. You cannot just ignore the other side, which is all sounds good. This all sounds fine. But the problem starts with the definitions, especially if you take other parts of the psyche into it, like consciousness and unconscious, because, and you will quickly figure out yourself, the logos is centered around words, and it's about separating things. So it's about seeing what should belong to each other and what should not, and being able to separate, which is important. On the eros side, it's about intermingling. It's combining things, things that should be together. And let's say a pathological logos side is you're separating so much that everything becomes basically dead. When you have an animal and you start separating all the things, then you have a dead animal. At the same, if you have pathological eros, this means everything gets suffocated because nothing can stand for itself. It just gets so intermingled that you don't even know where one thing starts and the other thing begins. Consciousness is the ability of human beings to differentiate, to really separate out things and focus on specific parts of reality. Because in the unconscious, everything is intermingled and it's not clear where one thing begins and the other thing ends. So what happens through the conscious process is that you take parts of the unconscious and differentiate them out, for example, through the cognitive functions. If you really want to be able to understand something, you need to be able to feel about it, think about it, sense about it, and intuit about it. There's already the huge overlap between logos and consciousness, and about unconscious and eros. And then you say, so this would in turn mean that men are more on the conscious side and women are on the unconscious side, which is then weird. And at the same time, he says, oh yeah, by the way, men really like thinking, because thinking is also a kind of differentiation, separating out and often abstract things. So thinking is always very an abstract aspect that is focus and logos in men. And feeling is very often what is missing then in man. And feeling means then of course also the entanglement and having an opinion and being earthbound, which is then more associated with women. So suddenly all these concepts correlate with each other. So when you have a modern personality model, like a way of describing personality, like the big five, you have the five traits, and they really are independent and not correlating with each other. You can have high openness and very high conscientiousness, and then you have won a big part in life. But you can also have very high agreeableness and very high neuroticism. And this is not so good. Let's say disagreeableness. Oh, this is even worse. Very low neuroticism and very low agreeableness, then very likely you're in jail. Stuff like that. But at least the things are not correlating with each other, except when you're very high conscientiousness, it's unlikely that you have high neuroticism because you're so orderly that not so many unstructured things are happening that might set up your fear senses. But for him, he presents all these things as separated. Logos, eros, thinking, feeling, male, female, consciousness, unconscious. But the definitions are so close to each other that I could say, okay, I cannot see how a thinking woman would then not be maybe unconscious all the time, because that's how the definition goes. And he then mentions also these things where he said, oh yeah, by the way, women are just from personality are very passive and need the masculine element to become pressurized and active in their life. And I think, okay, do you think these concepts are not related to each other and not correlating with each other, or are you? Because you're mingling them together, but first you're presenting them like they're not correlated with each other. And this part really with the logos and eros and the thinking and the feeling and the male, female and the conscious, unconscious, I have a really hard time to disentangle that. And I cannot find conclusive explanations, because his works do not go in this direction to show like, okay, there are places where this is not true. So you have an intermingling of concepts and to a certain degree for certain concepts, similar with extroversion and sensation. Sensation describing, realizing that there is something, which is the first part of experiencing something to be aware, there is something. Thinking is the next one, saying, it is this. Feeling is, how do I relate to that? And intuition meaning, okay, what could it be? And he says, people who are extroverted are incredible empiricists, because they pay attention to the details and the little things, and they take things as they are. Similar as sensation, where he also says, those are, by the way, incredible empiricists, because they look at the little things and how they are. And on the flip side, he says, introversion, these are the people who look inside. And he says, intuition is a function that looks inside and is closest related to the unconscious. And this is basically where people have access to their unconscious through their intuition. So again, there's an intermingling and correlation. It's also, if you would say, if you're extroverted, it's a 50% chance that you're also a sensation as your superior function. That would be okay, but he does not say that. He still treats everything as it would be not interrelated, but then the definitions overlap so much that I have to say, okay, it sounds like you're talking about the same thing. This goes, in my eyes, in a general tendency that Jung has. And this is, Jung really likes his polar opposites, because he says, you have the opposites, they can't come together, but you bring them together through a third, which is a symbol. And this is how you can integrate them. And I have the feeling that in some places, he's really pushing into the direction to separate out these opposites or dualities so far to really make them very strong in contrast. So in my eyes, he pushes into certain things, into corners where they become more like a caricature and more like a stereotype. For example, for men and women, it says, oh yeah, men are active, so women have to be inactive. It's like, oh yeah, that's a really broad generalization because looking around, I have see a lot of very active women, and I would not pretend like, okay, yeah, they're all in reality unconscious and they're just now animated by a masculine force, which would be a Jungian interpretation, very close to his concepts and his ideas. And I really have the feeling that he sometimes sees the world and how he presents it too much through his own concepts, and especially in the regards to the opposites, male, female, but also in the West and the East. I'm not completely sure that there's a 180-degree difference in psychology between the West and the East. Maybe it was in the past, maybe it is. But today, like, I work with Asians every day and we come pretty well along. And I don't have the feeling that they have no idea how causality works, how Jung presents it, not in a negative way, but he says, oh yeah, there's a different way of viewing at the world, but they see it in a holistic world, in a non-causal way. And I don't know whether the exact opposite of a Western European person is really a Chinese person, because that's what Jung says. I had some stuff like this in university where we had a scale and said, oh, we have different societies and these are very individualistic, those are very collective. Then you had America on one end and then Japan on the other end. And it's possible, maybe it is like that. Japan is incredibly collectivistic, America incredibly individualistic. But the question is, what about the other countries? Like, let's say Thailand. Like, do you now know Thailand better because it's closer to America in its degree of individuality than Japan? In my eyes, Jung leaves out there a lot of other cultures and countries, and but tries to, again, get this duality up. Because he says, without duality, we cannot perceive. And without duality, there is not this transfer of energy and change and transformation, because one thing changes from one state to the next. For him, it's really an energetic idea. Same as we have an electricity, we have a positive pole, we have a negative pole, and between them, we have the charge. And without this, of course, there would be no charge. And the bigger the difference, of course, the bigger the energy transfer. But to take this really in cultures and generalizing about broader groups of people, I'm not completely sure whether that's an accurate assessment. It says more about the psychology and ideas and concepts of Jung than about the countries and the people there themselves. As I said, it's possible that 100 years ago, the psychology in China was completely different. Also that it was maybe in the West different. Now we are more Easternized. It's also possible. But this is something where I have the feeling, as I said, he's pushing it into certain extremes to then have his opposites that he can then bring together through individuation and everything. And individuation is a keyword for my next topic, which is sometimes very hard for me to grasp, because he changes, seemingly sometimes changes his mind, whether individuation is a good thing or not a good thing. Also, whether it's happening by itself and you need to pay attention or not. This is something that I stumbled upon multiple times. He says, oh yeah, your psyche individuates all by itself. And the question is whether you take part in that. As he says, okay, yeah, in nature, the things also develop all by themselves. Agree, tree grows by itself without the consciousness. Similar as an animal grows also without a consciousness. But at the same time, he says, individuation is the separation from, let's say, unconscious forces, but also outside society. Like, already moving outside of the family circle is a form of individuation. Moving further out, not being related to any group, it's already a form of individuation. He says that when people form secret societies, it's already a separation step, because a secret separates one from the people that one has around one. And this is already an attempt of individuation. And it is not clear whether he is for it or against it. He says, okay, yeah, for the meaningful life, you should live the symbolic life and the life that is owned to you, which means living out your own individual psyche and becoming an individual through individuation. But at the same time, it says, yeah, individuation leaves people horribly alone and they're then not necessarily connected. And if you individuate, you owe a huge debt to society that society has to judge whether it's good what you offer or not. So the question is, okay, so does everybody should do individuation when it's a source of the meaning in one's life, to live one's symbolic life? And he says, yeah, well, that depends. Not everybody needs to individuate. But at the same time, he says, something in you individuates anyways, just as it does in nature for animals and for plants. And if you do not follow with your psyche, you will suffer horribly because you're not taking up your responsibility and the tasks that you need to do in your individual life. So this then leaves me very confused in the sense, is it good or bad? Or is it that you should do actively or not actively? Then going, of course, again into its warnings that you should not go into your unconscious, because if it would be really necessary, it would reveal by it itself to you. But if you do not recognize it, you will suffer horribly for it. So it then makes it very hard to give, let's say, Jungian advice. And he also does not give so much advice. His advice for individuation is really do the next logical thing, do the next step. And maybe this is so all-encompassing already that it's not worth to talk about it more. But at the same time, it sounds kind of important that you don't want to rift apart your psyche by ignoring your individuating impulses. So the question is really, okay, is it now reasonable suffering or is it unreasonable suffering? And here, there's not so much indication how to behave. So Jung as a self-help person would not be so useful. Does not tell you how to get into your body. And psychologically wise, helps to describe what is happening, let's say in an abstract manner, for example, dreams. But further than that, it's more like an individual journey and you make the things yourself, which is also a nice thing that you still have the agency to form then your own life. But the question is, okay, how much can Jung there really help? Because the advice is very general, like, okay, you have a shadow, you should confront the shadow, and you should try to integrate it. And it sounds great. And then the question comes, okay, how do I integrate my shadow? And this is also the questions where I struggle, because he does not really say that, right? You should acknowledge it, and you should contend with it, and you should integrate it, talk about it, write about it, all these things. But not going further into that. So for self-help guide, it will be a long search to find something in the works. All right. And my very last point is it has to do with synchronicity. And it has to do with his view on how the psychic bridges the gap to the material. Because his basis for that is the same basis which is also used by New Age people, which is quantum physics, very often coming from this is experiment or two experiments where they want to characterize an electron, where they say, okay, how does an electron behave? Does it behave like a particle or does it behave like a wave? The answer is depends on how you measure. You have different ways of measuring and dependent on how you measure, you find that all electrons are a particle or all electrons are a wave, which caused many people, also Jung, who's not a physicist, to draw the conclusion that the person observing the part with their consciousness has an influence how the part then materializes its behavior, whether it's like a particle or like a wave. So the idea is, okay, there in the, if you go low enough in physics, you get in the quantum sphere, and there the rules of Newtonian physics do not apply anymore in the same way as we're used to. And Jung sees there coincidences, meaningful coincidences, which he calls synchronicities, as a sign that there's a connective psychic layer in reality that causes certain things to happen. For example, he talks that weird things are happening when people die, for example, in their surroundings. Or he had one patient who he could not convince about the irrationality of the psyche and the unconscious things happening in her own psyche that dreamt of a scarab, this beetle that is in Egypt and used very often in Egyptian mythology, And it was at this session with this patient where she said, "No, I don't believe you," and she was not open to his ideas, that there was a clicking on the window. And she was talking about, "Oh, I had this really weird dream about this golden scarab, and I never saw such a thing in my life, and I don't know where it's coming from." And he opens the window, and on the window is this beetle, and he shows it to her and says, "Here's your scarab," and that completely blew her mind. And then she was open, and then they continue with the therapy. And for him, that's a synchronistic event. It is something meaningful happened, even though that there can't be a relation between the dream of a person and the beetle showing up at a window at this specific point in time. But he saw a connection there, and this connection for him is psychic and through meaning. And I still have a very hard time to wrap my head around that, even though that I talked multiple times about synchronicity. And I'm afraid that the point where he's coming from, if he goes that from the quantum physics standpoint, that this standpoint is just wrong and incorrect. That's not how quantum physics works or these experiments worked, which can be, let's say, a misunderstanding, or it can be, again, Jung picking out things that fit to his theories from other fields of study. This is open for everyone to discuss and decide. But this would conclude my different ideas and things that accumulated over time in the background of my mind when I talk about Jung. And as I said, when I talk in the events, I take it all 100% serious, and I try to bridge all the gaps that are there. And there are some gaps there where I just fill it basically with my own ideas and own associations to get a connection, because I always think, okay, it is coherent and there's a way to get everything together. But this event I wanted to use to point out certain things where I say, okay, there's maybe some creative freedom in there that is not necessarily bad, but this is how Jung operated. And then again, something where I think that should be talked about, because this will be the last big event in this introductory course of Jung that I created now over the last 2 years, which is now then the 27th event with a recording. And this chance I wanted to use to infuse a little bit of myself and my own thought processes and ideas a little bit more openly. And I want to thank you for listening to all of that. It's got pretty technical in between, but I hope you can follow along, and I hope that it helps in the end always to understand Jung's work, because it's still very amazing, and I guess nobody else could have done it. So this is already pretty high, not criticism, but let's say evaluation of something that is really amazing. So thank you very much for your attention.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Helpdesk. Also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.
Hearing this, I have to wonder, okay, this is true for the West. Like all this, when you read Ion, this maps on the history on the West very clearly. He even says, like, in the year 1000, there comes the second fish, and then the world goes horizontal instead of vertical, and all these things. And I wonder, okay, yeah, we still have a lot of other landmarks and people in the world. How does their psychology relate to the night sky that almost looks exactly the same? And how is that then tracked? This is also something I find weird. So, like, okay, is all the psychic development only happening in the Western mind? I cannot completely believe, but this is how he is painting it. To say, okay, yeah, the reason why the Germans invented Nazism is because in Mesopotamia, they started seeing animals in the night sky, and they recorded that, which is a like timeline you can draw without any problem through Jungian psychology. But if you then go to India or China, where he says, oh yeah, we have 5,000 years of uninterrupted cultural work, he does not really set it into context with the Chinese zodiac, right? For example, to say, okay, they could have 5,000 years uninterrupted, but in Europe, you get only a couple of hundred years, and then the next thing comes. Yeah, this is also something which is not so clear in Jung. I just remembered.